On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talk to the founder and CEO of Stitch Fix, an online retailer startup. We also talk about politics, football, and how to develop a personal brand. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, the intersection of marketing and technology, where we talk each week about what's happening on the internet, how brands are engaging with customers, whether it's customer service, sales, you name it, all the great tech startups that are out there that are actually building a brand around the internet and how it's being used to make us better consumers and better at business. And today, just like every other show, we have a really interesting guest that's going to talk about her business. It's Katrina Lake, who is the founder and CEO of something right up my alley, which is Stitch Fix. Welcome, Katrina, to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think I might have even said this before the pre-show, that I'm a bit of a fashionista. Let's just face it. There are certain retailers that actually know my name, and when I come in the door, kind of a family joke. When I show up, they're like, Tanya, it's like Norm on Cheers. So I'm super excited about what you're doing and what Stitch Fix is. So let's just jump into it. Stitch Fix, what is Stitch Fix?
Yeah, so Stitch Fix is an online personal shopper for an everyday woman. So the way that people in retail stores would know your name, our stylists would kind of serve the same purpose. And how it works is that our clients sign up through about a 10-minute long online profile, letting us know your general size and style preferences. Based on that, you'll schedule a date to get a Stitch Fix, and we will have a stylist who's selecting 5 items for you to try on at home. So it's just like getting a fitting room delivered. As you get more fixes, our stylist gets to know you well. And so we get better as a company, but our stylist also gets to know you better and styles better for you. And you simply keep what you want, send back what you don't want, and just pay for what you keep. So it's really very much like, you know, having a woman at a boutique who knows you super well, picking out 5 things for you and you being able to, you know, kind of just have a personal shopper, but at a price point that more women can afford. So our average price point is around $50 or $55. So, you know, you're thinking more of like a Gap-like price point.
Which I think it's a really powerful proposition. So you're actually not only providing, you know, an option for people who are very busy to buy clothes and have a personal shopper, which is typically something you have to be, you know, you can afford, right? So personal shopping can be kind of expensive. You certainly see really big retailers offering this that kind of cater to a high end, like maybe Bloomingdale's or that sort of thing. But you're you've got something that's available for the everyday woman.
And that's right.
As we were talking about before, we got this, a couple of other guests that we've got coming up, we're talking about how all their friends are using the service. and so I'm interested on this mini level. So let's just start with the fact that your background, one of the companies you worked for was Polyvore, which is another, you know, fashion meets internet type of business. And you were responsible for blogger outreach. And let's talk about where did you come up with this idea that you wanted to launch your own business doing this type of work?
Yeah, I had a few different inspirations. I think on one hand, from a business perspective, I had worked in retail and restaurant consulting and worked with a lot of very traditional brick and mortar retail and restaurant people and was frankly just fascinated by how little they knew about their customers. So there might be one waitress who knows you really well or one store associate who knows you really well. But as a company, they don't know when you walk in the door, like, is this a repeat customer? Does this person always order the same entree? Did this person buy these jeans last season? So I was really interested in the opportunity to be able to have kind of a better proposition for customers through understanding them better. And on the consumer side, my sister is like a buyer in New York. She's like always looks amazing. She puts this together from H&M and this together from Alexander Wang. And she's just one of these people who was born kind of with style. And so, you know, I've always been in that sister bucket of feeling jealous of how she can pull things together and always look great. And so there's a little bit of an element too of figuring out if there is a way to capture that for more of an everyday audience who's not shopping at Barney's, who doesn't have a stylist, you know, at their fingertips, to be able to have women feel the same way that you would feel by having a stylist, to feeling great about your decisions and feeling like, you know, you look great and you're confident every day. So those are some of the inspirations that went behind the business.
And there's been a big challenge for retailers to try to understand, especially I remember when, you know, TJ Maxx, for example, launched an internet-based, you know, site to help their customers buy online. And then they ended up taking it back down. And then they ended up, now they put something back up. And so I think you're right. But the traditional retailers in the clothing, in the fashion space, have really kind of struggled with how to, you know, because I think a lot of us want to touch our product. We want to feel our product.
Right.
We want that personalization, but I'm that woman that goes to a store and I don't try anything on at the store. I always take it home and
I do that too.
So you kind of bypass that step that I don't have to actually go to the store. And you learn my preferences, kind of like, I think like a Facebook or maybe a Pandora, I think I've heard you say does. I mean, you learn my preferences. How does that work? How do you understand me and what I want?
Yeah, Pandora is a great analogy. And so when we bring clothing in, Pandora does this with music where they say, you know, the genre that is assigned to it or whatever the metadata that's already attached to it is not enough. And they kind of have their own set of attributes that they apply to each song that helps them to understand these songs are like these other songs. And we do the same thing. And one of the hard things about fashion is that a striped shirt from this season might be totally different from a striped shirt from last season. And there's very little product that goes kind of across seasons from the same vendor where you can really, you know, learn a lot. So you really do have to make your own data to be able to extrapolate across seasons and across vendors what works and doesn't work. And so when you fill out your online profile, you're letting us know kind of like what your preferences are. When we have apparel that comes in, we actually assign our own set of like preferences to that so that we can understand the data. And what we really focus on is, you know, it's not fabrication that's most important. It's not often even price that's most important to customers. It's like, how is this going to fit on my bust? How is this going to fit on people who are my height? And so, you know, we really kind of simplify it so that we understand, you know, these types of clothes work for these types of people. And then importantly, over time, you know, when somebody gets 5 items in the mail, they actually let us know for everything what they're keeping, what they're not keeping, and importantly, why. So that helps us to learn about customers overall so that when we see customers that show up who look like you, who have preferences like you, it helps. But importantly, it also helps us understand you better. So there's a part of it that is on the data side, but there's actually part of it that's just on the soft side so that when a stylist is pulling up your a fix for you in the future, she can actually see all of your written comments and she can see, you know, what you liked about certain things, what you didn't like about certain things. And that really helps her to be able to curate her next selection for you.
And this is so powerful. If you think about just the idea of listening to your customer and catering to them, nothing could be more important to your business.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, she just wants to be understood.
Most women do, right? Most of us probably are. I like I said this before, I love to pin. So I'm constantly, I have this board on Pinterest that I call My Closet. And it's tons of things. I always say Pinterest is Pinterest is the person we want to be, or the closet we want to have, the clothes we want to have. How do you use technology, like maybe social communities or anything like that? Is that something that you engage to help people understand, you know, or to help, you know, your shopper to understand what your consumer wants? Is that a place you've gone yet?
Yeah, it is. And Pinterest actually in particular is a really valuable one for us. So as a customer, when you sign up and you let us know your preferences, you can include a link to your Pinterest. And our stylists love that. I mean, there is nothing that is more helpful to them than to see actual product that you are wanting or that you're wishing for this season. And so that's one of the most valuable tools that you as a client can provide to our stylists to be able to style better for you. And we see people who, I mean, it's amazing. We see people who customize a whole Pinterest board just for their Stitch Fix account so that they can say, like, I have these white jeans. I have this cardigan. I want this thing. Like, you know, and kind of like be able to give us even more context around what they're pinning. But it's amazing. I mean, the Pinterest board is a huge, huge help to our stylists. And that's something that we love to get. We actually have our buyers use it also. So we can see of our clients, what types of things in aggregate people are pinning the most, and supply that to our buyers as they're going to market. So there's all kinds of really creative ways that we can use people's social presence outside of Stitch Fix to be able to help us style better for our clients.
What about the part where, okay, so I'm in love already, so I don't even want to see other people. We're like, no. I love this concept because I think I've wanted this for a long time, and I'm surprised nobody else is really doing this the way that you are, and certainly with the popularity that you have. But there's the physicality of actually going to a store and looking around and shopping yourself and then carrying the item around, maybe in your hand or and you kind of feel this ownership whether you buy it or not. How does that translate to just saying, here, I trust you, shop for me, and then and getting products in the mail? How does that translate?
Yeah, so I mean, it's really, and it's interesting that we don't, you know, we always talk about too how it's interesting that we haven't seen much in the way of competition. I mean, some of it, it's really hard. Like what we have in our back end is basically, you know, the equivalent of a department store and a warehouse combined. So when our, you know, we actually own our inventory. We buy our inventory 3 to 6 months in advance with buyers who came from places like Macy's and Nordstrom's. So our model is more similar to a department store than anything. And we actually have to have that depth of inventory like a department store. So when you sign up, we need to have denim in your size. We need to be able to have, you know, dresses that are colors that you don't hate. Like we need to have the exact right assortment to be able to ship you 5 things that you're going to love. And that's definitely one of the hardest things that we do. So yeah, I mean, there is this idea that I think so many people, and people ask sometimes, why do you own the inventory? You know, we could in theory just link to like, oh, you might like this thing on Shopbop or you might like this thing on J.Crew, but we can control the experience so much more when we have the inventory here. And there are things like we have our own size scale. So we might have something that the vendor marks it a small, medium, large, but we know that the large only fits a size 10 and it wouldn't fit a size 12. You know, we can redo that in our system so that we can send it to the right people. So owning our inventory helps us to be able to have a much more consistent supply, and it helps us to be able to kind of know what the right size is going to be for you better. But it does make it really hard. But you know, one of the things that we've learned is to, and you mentioned this earlier, women just want to try things on. Like it's not enough to just see it on a screen. You want to see it on your body. You want to see it with your shoes. You want to get your husband's opinion. And those are all things that are hard to do, you know, just in a store, and you have to do it through this at-home model. So there's a lot of benefits to owning the inventory, but it's definitely, one of the more difficult things that we do.
And I think I imagine anyway, so just, you know, I would say all humans, but certainly women specifically, we tend to be a little, you know, conscious of, you know, maybe we like this part about our body or we don't like this part about our body.
Right.
And I guess, you know, how do you overcome that when you get women specifically talking about, you know, this is what I look like, help me fit clothes to this body? How do you get them to share that information?
Yeah, we get amazingly, amazingly honest. I mean, very touching kind of about us comments, and just like we get very, very, we get a lot of information from our customers in ways that it's very personal. And it truly, like, I mean, there are a couple of fixes. I style 5 fixes a week. There are a couple of fixes that I styled last week where women were sharing like very specifically about how they felt about their post-pregnancy weight and how they felt about not being able to fit, you know, specific types of clothes or wanting to, you know, hide their arms until they get toned in their arms. And I mean, you just, you know, women are very, very, I think, as we said earlier, I think at the end of the day, she just wants to be understood. And there are ways that she's going to look amazing kind of no matter what her figure or no matter what her, you know, what parts of her body she feels better or worse about. And we need to just be able to help her navigate that. And so it's, you know, people ask me, it's a funny question. People ask me like, do women lie about their weight? And we don't really find that. I think women are pretty honest with us and trust us a lot. But most importantly, you know, we really demonstrate that we're going to be able to do better for her the better we understand her. And I'm just constantly touched by how much more women are like willing to share with us and how much they're, you know, how much they trust us, and our stylists really value that feedback, and it really helps them to understand her better the more women share with us.
So right now you cater to women. What about men? I mean, how, you know, when are you going to start catering to the male fashionistas out there?
Probably not anytime soon. You know, women spend a lot of money, and there's still a lot more women that we have to serve. And I think we're still scratching the surface of what we can do in the women's market. So truthfully, we kind of have our hands full here for the time being. But someday we'd love to serve the men in their lives too. So, you know, we'd love to get there someday, but not anytime soon.
And I guess, you know, the question that comes to mind is, as someone who's named her own business and you try to figure out the right name, we were joking before the show started because Stitch Fix, Stitch Fix it's memorable. But what drove you to that name?
So truthfully, I actually had it. We had a different name when we first launched for like a couple months, and we had the benefit of being able to have learned what your business was going to be about for a couple of months, and then having to rename it, which at the time was super painful, but it was great because it helped for me to be able to say, like, this is what I want or don't want in a name. And so Fix was actually the word that I really wanted, because we needed something to call the box when it shows up. And so we needed, you know, somebody to be able to say, I'm getting my fill in the blank. That, like, a box didn't sound kind of interesting enough, and it needed to be something. So Fix was the word that we landed on. That was going to be the name for what the box showed up. And then Stitch, we actually just, you know, it ends up being this kind of Venn diagram of like what URL is available, what trademark is available, and what makes sense for your company. And Stitch Fix made the most sense, but we really love the Fix part of it because people can say, I'm getting my fix next week, or I can't wait to get my fix. And so we really can own that word.
So, and I'm going to be totally addicted. I know I'm going to love this. So I love Pinterest for the same reason. I feel like I'm shopping, and so it'll feel really easy. I think, and you make it easy because it's a very low cost of entry. In fact, I've heard, I think you say free, but with a kind of a catch. So explain how somebody would sign up for your service.
Yeah, so you sign up and you let us know your general size and style preferences. You'll schedule a date to get a fix. And then in terms of how you pay, there's a $20 styling fee that gets charged when your fix leaves our distribution center. But that $20 is actually credit to anything that you buy in that fix. So for the vast majority of our customers, the whole experience feels free because they're buying at least one item out of their fix. If you don't buy any items and you send the whole thing back, the styling fee helps us to offset, you know, our costs on the styling and shipping side. But the vast majority of our customers will buy at least one item. And so for them, the whole experience is free.
So let's talk about demographics. I imagine, and it's funny because before we started, there was a lot of conversation about the men that are going to be on this show are talking about the women that they know are all using your service. I'm kind of left out. I need to be using it already. But, you know, I imagine that you've already kind of outlined a profile of who your customer is. Who is the Stitch Fix customer?
The thing that we find across all of our customers is really that she has this feeling of being time starved. And that can be true for, you know, a 25-year-old urban professional who's trying to get to that, you know, next promotion and, you know, trying to build her career. It can also be true for a stay-at-home mom in Nashville who's juggling four kids. So really that kind of time-starved woman is really the profile that we're finding is consistent across all of the women who do Stitch Fix. But very much like a department store, you know, we are able to cater to multiple demographics. And so, you know, we have kids who just graduate from college who are starting their first job, all the way up to like the moms of Stitch Fix clients, of women who are, you know, 65 years old and want to look, you know, more fashionable in their towns. And it really is a range, like a department store. We really can cater to a wide range of demographics. But the ones who appreciate us most and the ones who love us most are time-starved women and often time-starved moms. You know, taking a toddler to a Bloomingdale's is not an exciting thing to think about. And so, you know, the service really does, it really does provide a lot of value to women who are super, super busy, and especially women who are super, super busy and, you know, kind of constrained in terms of what they can do in a physical shopping experience, because of, you know, being time starved, but also just, you know, wanting to spend time with your kids rather than, you know, parking in a parking lot at the mall or waiting in line at the mall. And, you know, we can kind of give her time back in her life.
Well, and I don't really see malls as, you know, sorry to all the malls out there, but I don't see people really mall shopping anymore. And I'm a much more of a boutique shopper, I think, in general. But I think, I guess, so my first question is, you know, we're talking about demographics. Can someone outside of the United States use your service?
No, currently we're just in the U.S.
And inside the U.S., are there certain parts of the country where you have more, you know, penetration, like maybe urban, or is it rural? I mean, where are people finding you? How are you marketing to the right customer?
So all of our growth has actually been through word of mouth. And a lot of that word of mouth is through traditional, like women telling other women. This category is a great category because women talk. You know, women are like, oh, I love your necklace. I love your blouse. And then the next thing that comes out of her mouth is, oh, it's from this service called Stitch Fix, and explaining what it is. And so we get a lot of just natural, organic word of mouth. We talked about bloggers earlier. That was a channel I worked a lot with when I was at Polyvore, and a channel that we still work a lot with here at Stitch Fix. And bloggers have just been an amazing, amazing channel for us of being able to, you know, kind of talk about what they're getting in their fixes, and to be able to provide a tool to bloggers for engagement on their blog with their readers, but at the same time, you know, helping us grow and helping us to grow awareness of the service. So those have been like our biggest channels to date. In terms of how to, you know, our reach, we're really broad across the U.S. It's pretty amazing. Usually you'd see a newer startup or kind of a first adopter type of thing focus more on urban markets like San Francisco and New York. And we actually found pretty early on that we were very broad from day one, really. And I think a lot of that has to do with a lot of our word of mouth coming from bloggers and influencers, just because, you know, bloggers and influencers can really be anywhere. Like, you know, I think there's tons and tons. There's some amazing statistic about the number of women in Oklahoma who are on Pinterest. And, you know, we benefit a lot from just, you know, using bloggers who are very, very influential in their communities, whether those communities be, you know, in Manhattan or in Minnesota. And so we really found that, you know, our demographic in a lot of ways just mirrors like where population is. So it's not necessarily that we're over-indexing anywhere, but I think for a startup, you usually see it stronger in San Francisco and New York. And we got pretty broad pretty fast.
Yeah, you have, and you've been growing. And like you said, this is fascinating too, this whole word of mouth philosophy that you've not had to use any traditional marketing. You're focusing on the success and the relationship you have with your current customers and how much they love it. And there mm-hmm. couldn't be better marketing than word of mouth marketing. So my question then would be, you know, which is great, but you're the CEO, you're the founder of this company. What have you learned about whether it's marketing or cost of entry, which you do have a lot of overhead, I'm sure, having all these clothes. I mean, what have you learned since launching the startup?
Oh, wow. I've learned so much. Trying to think where to start. I mean, I've learned that people in the business are super, super valuable. So I have an amazing team. I have an amazing executive team. I'd never started a company before, and it was very important to me that I make sure that I surround myself with talented people who know all the things that I don't know. And so people really, I think, are the biggest, just the most valuable part of the business, and the most valuable part of what we invested in as a company early on. On the marketing side, I mean, we were so lucky, truthfully. I mean, this business is really hard, and we talked a little bit about the inventory, but in the early days, for the first 6 months of this company, we didn't even have a website. I mean, you went to stitchfix.com and there would be a link there to fill out a survey, and then all the, you know, shipping information stuff, everything we just did through email. So you'd get an email saying your fix is shipped, and we would collect your feedback sometimes in handwritten responses and then have somebody transcribe them. I mean, we literally didn't have a website for the first 6 months. And that's because all the money that I raised, we had to put into inventory. Like, that's just the business that we're in. if we don't have five items to ship to somebody, we have no business. And so inventory was more important than a website in the early days. And so, you know, there are a lot of like trade-offs that I had to make early on. And we were super lucky that our customers loved the service from the beginning and talked about it from the beginning. Because truthfully, we just, you know, it helped us to be able to focus on just getting the business up and running before we had to focus on, you know, brand and marketing and how we were going to help our customers to share. So those are some of the big things. But, you know, on the marketing side, it's not necessarily by something that we did on purpose. But one of the things that I learned is that this service just inherently is a very, very shareable experience. So you don't know the five things that are showing up. You want to get feedback from people about what you should keep and what you should send back. And so all of those things really lend to sharing, whether it is on a blog or whether it's on Instagram. And so, you know, we benefit a lot from that. And maybe the last thing is on packaging. If you Google for Stitch Fix and Google Images, a lot of the images are actually of the outside of the box, or they're of the items very nicely folded inside. And so a lot of the packaging things, it just seems like an afterthought for some companies, but we've really seen a lot of value in it. Because every time somebody gets a fix and it's beautifully packaged and they put it up on the Instagram, you know, that's a few hundred other eyeballs who are seeing that package and getting introduced to Stitch Fix. And so the packaging actually has gotten us a long way as well.
I am so happy to hear you say that. One of the things I do here at Twit is I get a lot of products in for us to review, right? And packaging is so important. Your immediate reaction that you have to the product that you're opening is going to be have an impact. I mean, whether it's right. just thrown in a cardboard box and you're opening it, or it's got this really nice package. You've got a nice, like I just got something, you know, last Friday, it's like a handwritten note to me and, you know, some candy was in there, which, you know.
Well, that's what's amazing is like in the stores world, people, you know, you invest in all these fixtures and you invest in the store looking beautiful and having this amazing atmosphere and having a signature scent. And why aren't retailers doing the same thing in their packaging? Because, you know, all those things they're doing in the store is to elevate the store experience so that you feel like you're buying something really luxurious and you feel like you're part of the lifestyle. And that same experience should translate to the package that you get at home. And it's just amazing to me how little that has happened.
And it's funny because if you think about brands that do really focus on a on packaging, if Tiffany's or even Redbox, which is an online retailer, I mean, people like the fact that they're getting the red box or the blue or aqua, whatever Tiffany's right. color is. So it is really important. I'm glad to hear you focus on that. I'm really excited about what you're doing. And so I guess another question I would have then as a CEO, as like to your point, this is your first startup. I mean, this is a, you know, you've grown a lot in just the last 3 years. What's something, and I think you may have mentioned this when you talked about kind of your experience from here, there, then to now, but what would you say is something you thought maybe was a mistake that you would advise somebody else maybe to do differently if they had their own startup?
I'm trying to think what mistake I've made. A good question. I mean, I've made many, many mistakes along the way. There's no question about that. But I mean, I think the customer experience, like not sacrificing on customer experience is something. So, and actually it maybe my head's just on it because we're talking about packaging, but there was a point in time when we shipped out in a poly bag. And to be honest, like you couldn't read, like, it's not like the customer complained and said, I want a box instead of a poly bag. They wouldn't explicitly tell you that. And so it was a decision I had to reverse to kind of go back to boxes without being able to quantify it. There might be a way to do a long A/B test to see like if customers with poly bags are better than boxes. I mean, are worse than boxes, but like some of it is just like a gut feel. And so I think one of the things that, you know, the mistakes that I try not to make now are mistakes that, detract from the customer experience and trying to figure out, you know, ways, making sure that we're always making decisions that are improving it and not making decisions that are taking away from it. But yeah, I mean, and the other thing is really just people are everything. And so just making sure that we have really great people and really great mentors for people here is something I focus on a lot.
I think to your point, you're not making a lot of mistakes. That's why you're doing so well. And the mistakes you're making, you're learning from and moving on pretty quickly. You're embracing them and you're saying, okay, let's do things this way. I mean, who is the hockey player, Anthony, that says, you know, you, you, miss 100% of the shots? Is it Gretzky that you don't take? No? He doesn't know. Are you a hockey fan?
No, I think that's right.
And I think you're taking lots of shots. I think as a startup, you've done phenomenally well. You think you're continuing to capture the attention of a lot of people. What's next? I mean, I mentioned men's fashion. How are you planning to continue to grow? Are you just going to get bigger? Are you going to launch new things?
Truthfully, at present, we're really just focusing on scale and growth and meeting our demand and meeting the demand that we have from our customers. So we've just been really fortunate to have all this organic growth, and we really need to hustle a little bit more to be able to catch up to it. And so that's truthfully what we're most focused on now. But really, you know, we are focused very much on this customer and this woman and all the ways that we can make her life better. And we're hopeful we can continue to add. We added bags, for example, this year. We added denim actually last year. It's hard to imagine now that we didn't have it before. But, you know, we're keeping a close ear to the ground to understand kind of what we can do to continue to make her life better. And hopefully we'll continue to add categories and add things that will make her life better. But we really have our hands full right now with just meeting demand and scaling. So so that's truthfully what most of what the team is focused on.
I'm really excited about
on a we've got to get you a fix.
I know. I'm going to be totally addicted to this. I know I am. I'm addicted to Pinterest, and I don't even have to do anything with that. Well, I just have loved what you're doing. We tried to get you on, I think, when you were at South by Southwest talking about what you're doing, and you're doing such a great job. Everybody is hearing about you, and it's changing the way that we market our business. It's just being better at it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks again for joining us for the show.
Thanks for having me. I've
appreciated your time. I hope you had a good holiday weekend, and we'll have you back on to talk about the next evolution when that happens.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
And if somebody wants to connect with you real quick, or they want to sign up for Stitch Fix, what's the best way they can do that?
Yeah, just go to stitchfix.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Pinterest. And all of it will be at Stitch Fix.
Sounds great. Thanks again. And have a great rest of your week.
Thank you. You too.
So, kind of excited to talk to our next guest. I'm actually, do I have time to sign up for Stitch Fix in the meantime? Probably not. But I will be doing that today, I'm sure. Our next two guests are our friend Brian Rich, who is the managing director of Little M Media, and CC Chapman, who is, as he calls himself, storyteller for hire. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, there he is. Wait, I kind of halfway expected, Brian, to see your Muppet sitting in the chair with the headset, but no?
Oh, no, sorry. But he's up there. He's constantly looking over me with that kind of scowl on
his... He is scowling. Why did your mom pick a scowling one for you? Are you a scowler?
No. I'm sure she just felt I needed to stay in line.
Well, as most women think... men in their lives, stay in line.
Moms, you know.
Moms. Okay. You know, Brian, you've been on the show many times. We love what you're doing, and I'm super excited about some of our topics today on social marketing space. And Cece, welcome. Tell us, what does it mean to be, Cece, a storyteller for hire? What is that?
Well, it's one of those things where I've always had a knack. I mean, I ran a marketing agency for a number of years. I do a lot of public speaking. And lately I've realized, you know, everyone's trying to figure out content marketing. Everybody's trying to figure out marketing as a whole. And so I get hired to come in, and whether it's finding the strategy for a company, you know, what their story is, and then how to tell it. Is it words? Is it images? Is it videos? And that's what it is. People hire me to do that for them.
So, You are a good storyteller, though. You've done a lot of different things, and you think and Brian have. You guys know each other, right? You've met in person.
We were reconnecting over Twitter while you were doing the first section of the show, and it was one of those. My bad for forgetting. We have met. We've been on a panel together. So yes, we do know each other.
I'm easily forgettable, but it was a long time ago. So I didn't see
the Muppet last time. I would have remembered the Muppet. Well,
that's not true, Brian. That's not
it's true. Part of the issue. No, but you know, let me pick up on what Cece was saying, because I think this whole figuring out the content space and the content marketing space is really important. The word content marketing, or the phrase content marketing, is being tossed around more than ever. There are, you know, more brands and more you know, companies of all types saying, you know, we need to be in conversation and we need to be able to put our information out there and engage with people. But you know, there actually is a lot that we don't understand or that we aren't doing well. And I think there are very few people who are sort of in the position that Cece is in, and I do some of the same stuff, probably more complimentary than competitive to the types of things that Cece does. But, you know, people who have just frankly been around and have played with all these different channels and platforms and have, you know, had their ups and downs on different marketing efforts and have some sense of what maybe we should be trying or you know, starting to institutionalize in some way. It's just a very interesting, challenging sort of time. And I think, and it's sort of a question, I guess, Cece, for you is, it seems to me like part of the challenge that exists for you and me and people in this kind of content marketing space is that nobody really knows quite what to hire us for. They don't quite know what to pay for, but if it doesn't look like what we've done in the past, which is sort of the goal of all this, then, you know, it's not that easy to get them to keep committing and keep evolving in most cases.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, everybody, you know, especially because content marketing is such a buzzword these days, everybody thinks, oh, I can just whip out my phone and shoot a video. And yeah, you can do that. But is it going to be compelling enough that it's going to get you what you need out of it? And it is it's a difficult time. It's one of those reasons where, you know, I could call myself a marketing consultant. I could call myself this or that. But at the end of the day, it's about crafting a really good story for a client. And they don't know what they necessarily need because they hear about social media or they read a post about, you know, the best time to post something is this. And we all know that that's kind of fluffy and not necessarily true. So it's interesting. And what's fun, though, is when, while it's hard for lots of companies to figure out they need this, when you have that company that comes to you and says, hey, we need your help. And yes, we know we're going to pay you for it and we're going to appreciate it. That makes it all worthwhile, because when you get to work with someone or a brand or a NGO or a nonprofit or whatever it is that it gets it, it's worth all the other times when you're banging your head against the wall trying to convince somebody.
So banging your head. Go ahead, Brian.
Can I follow up? I have a quick follow up. So I have a beef with the word story or storytelling, because I think it's become a buzzword, and I'm curious what you think about this. My beef is that, like many other buzzwords and trends in the digital and social marketing space, that, you know, the idea of storytelling has become sort of a silver bullet, a perfect answer. People are saying, all you need is a good story. All you need is the ability to tell your story. But of course, every organization has a different communication challenge. And as the world continues to change and turn, and what happens in the news or what happens with the weather, whatever it is, the storytelling challenge changes. So I wonder, just, you know, I try to frankly avoid the word storyteller and storytelling. I'm curious, you know, whether you've run up against that or you have a sense of that, and why you did land on storyteller or storytelling as the trade that you're in.
Yeah. No, I run into it all the time, and you're right. It has been co-opted as a horrible buzzword. Just like I think content marketing got, you know, turned into a buzzword.
Social media in general.
Social media, yeah. All of them. And the way I came about it was, you know, I mean, I've been blogging for 10 years. I take lots of photos. I do podcasts, and I couldn't figure out any other word that kind of encompassed everything I did but storytelling. And yeah, it is. And it does kill me, because it is a big buzzword right now. I mean, there's storytelling classes, and you know, I think it always freaks out clients when the first thing I sit down with them is, and I said, okay, let's talk about your strategy. What is it you're trying to do? And they're like, whoa, I thought we were going to do content. I'm like, well, yeah, but if you don't know where you're doing, if you don't know what you're trying to do, you know, I ran into this all the time with marketing campaigns too. They're like, here's a bunch of money. Go make us, you know, go get buzz, or, you know, whatever the, you know, and it drives me nuts. But it's a tough word, but I've yet to find out anything else that describes what I do that isn't totally like some crappy, douchey tech rock star type of term that I hate even more. So I roll with storyteller, and I come from it from an old fashioned standpoint of storytelling.
I was telling Brian this morning that somebody wanted to connect with me on LinkedIn, and their title was Social Media Genius, which I wanted to just be sick at my stomach a little bit. And hopefully they were saying that, you know, Parsifal, hopefully it was a joke. But so, trying to avoid too many buzzwords, let's talk about social media and the storytelling that's happened this weekend for Memorial Day. Okay. It was a long weekend. A lot happened. I know, Brian, one of the things you were really paying close attention to was auto racing, right? Grand Prix, Indy 500 type stuff. Let's talk. What's happening in the auto racing arena?
Well, so the reason I mean, first of all, if you know me, I'm a big sports nut, and Memorial Day weekend is one of the great kind of sports, you know, periods, 3-4 day period, because it really starts leading into the weekend, and actually going into this week, you have the National Spelling Bee, which I consider a sport that sort of rounds it all out. But on Saturday, was it Saturday? Yeah, the Grand Prix of Monaco, which is sort of the greatest race in Formula One, the Indy 500, which is the greatest spectacle in racing, and the Coca-Cola 600, which is NASCAR's longest race of the season, were all staged. The Monaco Grand Prix started at 7:30 a.m. Eastern time. The Indy flag went down just after noon, and then the Coca-Cola 600 was sometime into the evening. And, you know, what's so interesting to me from a social standpoint is how the different networks and the different audiences for Formula One, Indy, and NASCAR all kind of covered their races and their experiences differently, and how it related to the television experience. Because, you know, racing is racing, and there's, you know, constant action. So you never actually saw a full commercial, I think, during the Monaco Grand Prix, because they always had a split screen, and that was interesting. You had that a couple times in the other races, but then you also had controversy at the end of the Indy 500 with the split screen, because a lot of folks on social felt like, you know, they weren't actually showing enough of the race. You know, the important part of the action in the final lap and a half or so when the race was decided. So, you know, I just think it's one of those things when you're looking at different ways, if you will, to tell stories and engage fans and figure stuff out. Here you have, you know, three of sort of the same types of events to compare all in one day, and what they did with digital and social were sort of notable and interesting to me.
So, and you know, especially if you think of auto racing and advertising, you know, on the vehicles and on cars, you really need to be able to see that for the advertiser to get the biggest bang for their buck, because they're not really trying to advertise as much to the people that are there, but to people that are watching from home. Who did well at capitalizing on that with the second screen experience?
You know, I would have to say that I probably don't remember a single advertiser from when I was watching the race. I do think if you take the Grand Prix of Monaco, Mercedes had the top two vehicles, the pole sitter who ran wire to wire and the number two who held off a very fierce challenge from the guy who finished third. And, you know, I was texting with my father-in-law. I was, you know, talking to other people, and, you know, the number of times I must have said Mercedes and, you know, how impressive those engines were and what they were doing, I think is notable. So, you know, the lesson I take often from marketing in racing is, you know, the product matters more than the marketing. So if it's a Ford engine that wins the NASCAR race, that makes me think highly of Ford. If it's a Mercedes team that leads you to victory in the Grand Prix of Monaco, you know, Mercedes, I might go check out Mercedes and see what they're doing in the racing field and everywhere else, much more so than someone who, you know, split screens or, you know, tries to game social media for a conversation, because I'm there to watch the race. And in that case, those brands are deeply embedded into the race itself.
Cece, are you a sports fan?
Huge sports fan. Sports fan.
What are your favorite sports?
Not auto racing. I'm football, hockey, and lacrosse. And this weekend was the National Lacrosse Championship, which was cool to watch. And I was laughing when I saw the link about the auto racing, because I wasn't watching the race, but talking about that the split screen was messed up. During the National Championship, the lacrosse thing, they had one of those spider cams that flies above the field. And it was horrible. The last minute of the game, it's not a blowout, and they're off trying to follow lacrosse, which is a fast moving sport, and they did a horrible job at it. I was literally screaming at the television going, what are you doing? This isn't the time to experiment with a new camera. But, you know, obviously spider cam, and the only reason I remember the name was because they obviously paid for it, because there was a big watermark, you know, a little bug up in the right hand corner saying spider cam footage. And I remember thinking, well, spider cam, I hate you now, because you made me miss the last 30 seconds seconds of the game. So it kind of backfired, at least for me. But
That's not a good brand placement, I think. Let's talk just about sports in general, because Brian, you and I have talked a lot about this. And, you know, we're talking about second screens, but who's done a really good job? I mean, look at Stitch Fix, right? So their whole marketing plan is just relationship building with customers, which I so love that about them, and the word of mouth placement. But so how does that affect sports? Who's really doing, what industry, I guess, is it, or sports area? Is it baseball? Is it football? Is it, I mean, you know, who's capitalizing? Is it, or is it racing? Who's capitalizing on the social consumer relationship aspect?
No, I mean, I think I've said this before. I say it all the time. I think Major League Baseball is probably the most sophisticated media company on the planet. And the way that they take the, you know, 16 live games worth of content, you know, most of the days throughout the season, and you know, put it across a variety of different channels and you know, socialize and all of that is powerful. I still think, you know, for all of the incredible social digital sophistication that you're seeing from Major League Baseball, from the National Football League, you know, even from the NBA and the NHL, which are in the midst of their playoffs right now, you know, most of it still caters to the super diehard fan who's going and looking for that information. And what I think is missing in terms of this kind of second screen experience is that way for a casual fan to come in and say, oh, the Indy 500, I've heard about it. That's really compelling. You know, how do I convert from being just an Indy 500 fan to someone who might watch, you know, the Indy series? Or lacrosse is a great example. I love Memorial Day weekend for the two semifinals on Saturday and the final on Monday in the NCAA lacrosse. But, you know, there's almost no mention at all of the professional lacrosse leagues that exist and, you know, the ways that maybe I would get my kids to play lacrosse or similar. So there's just this huge missed opportunity, I think, with these second screens still among all the sports to kind of say, wait, this live event or this special event is capturing, you know, a new fan or an occasional fan. How are we going to actually deepen that connection and convert them into something, you know, that might stick later?
What do they need to do differently, Cece, since that's a sport you're really paying attention to? What would you advise them to do, or what do you think they should do to change that missed opportunity?
Well, I think one of the things, I know I agree with everything you just said. One of the things I've seen is you see individual teams doing it really, really well. Like I know I'm not a fan, the San Francisco Giants do a fantastic job with social media. My beloved Miami Dolphins do a great job with getting it out there and getting things out there. Seattle, I know you're a Seattle fan, you know, they as well. But it's weird because you see these individual teams realizing, I know 12th man, it was all good. I saw Obama with the flag, it was awesome. I rooted for him. But I just think it's one of those things where I think they really need to do a good job of, they need to do a better job of realizing that the diehard fans, they've got them. They're not going to lose them. But getting more casual fans in, whether it's, you know, contests or more information on the television. I know, like me personally, I hate having a second screen when I'm watching sports usually. I actually enjoy watching the game. I know, shocking, right? Social media guy. I'm also the guy when I go to a rock concert, my phone stays in my pocket where it should be because I'm there for the music and the experience. So I think it's a balancing act. You know, you see all these people at like live sporting events, you know, venues are trying to make sure there's solid Wi-Fi. They're trying to make sure that, you know, you there as a spectator can share stuff out. I think that's very, very smart. There's nothing worse than you do take a picture and you can't share it out. But I think sports have to be really smart about it. I think the idea with lacrosse, upselling to pro lacrosse is a great idea. And let's face it, lacrosse is one of those sports that's never on television except during the playoffs. ESPN, thankfully, has been giving them more exposure lately. And I didn't grow up playing lacrosse. I got into it because my son got into it, and now he plays high school lacrosse. And I've become a complete fanatic about lacrosse. But if it's ever going to expand, if it's ever going to grow, soccer has the same problem. If it's ever going to get to the level they would like in the United States, they've got to do more to get it out there in the face of people to say, this is fun. It's on television. You can watch it. You can go experience it. It's still a cheap alternative to something like football, where it's really expensive to go to a football game, but I can go to a lacrosse game or a soccer game for almost nothing when compared for tickets.
You know, it's funny. Brian and I are going to do a whole thing around soccer coming up soon. So that'll be interesting. Well, you mentioned that Brian is a fan of the Seattle Seahawks, which, you know, anybody who knows Brian or follows him on social media couldn't know anything different because you're such a diehard fan. But you actually recently, I was watching your Facebook, you took a bunch of pictures at the White House when the Seattle Seahawks were there. How do you get these little sweet gigs where you get kind of these exclusive invites? I got to find out.
Well, in that case, I actually called someone who I know who works at the White House, and I offered a kidney, which he has not he has not collected on yet, thankfully. But, you know, it's interesting because I actually think that the challenge of engaging, you know, sports fans and casual sports fans versus diehards is sort of the same challenge that exists for anyone right now. So you were talking fashion before, and, you know, someone who you know, knows what styles they like and actively shops and goes for it, you know, they're fine, right? The internet offers a wonderful array of, you know, ways for you to buy clothes. But for someone who doesn't know what they like and wants to be trendier, et cetera, something like Stitch Fix, you know, offers them that on-ramp, if you will, to getting more engaged. So I think this exists all the same. And what I, you know, the reason that I went to the White House or pushed to go to the White House is because, you know, it is a once in a lifetime experience, at least for a Seattle fan. It feels like, you know, to be at that pinnacle. Most of us as fans of any brand are kind of constantly disappointed and constantly, you know, fall short of these lofty expectations that we have. And, you know, so if you don't take advantage of something like going to the White House and seeing the president, you know, honor your team and, you know, sitting in the East Room and chanting, you know, Seahawks, Seahawks, Seahawks with, you know, all of these other people who share that passion, you know, if you don't take that opportunity when it exists, you know, it's not like you're being afforded that many other opportunities. So I think a lot of it comes down to just, you know, I called in this favor because I didn't know the next time the Seahawks are going to win the Super Bowl. I didn't know the next time the president was going to invite any team that I, you know, grew up watching or love and respect and all of that, you know, anywhere close to him. So, you know, hell yeah, I'm going to take advantage of that and post the crap out of it online for everyone else to see and okay. Be jealous of, hopefully.
Yeah. And I think your pictures got used, right?
Yeah, well, look, and I mean, CeCe, poor CeCe here is a Miami Dolphins fan. Like,
poor CeCe.
I mean that in the sense that, you know, all of the stories coming out of the Dolphins for the last year and a half have been not just they underperformed on the field, but they've been negative, right? This destroys you as a fan to see, you know, this group that you invest your time and energy and love in to disappoint you. Like, you have to take advantage of the highs and you have to figure out a way to deal with the lows. I don't think that's unique to sports, but it's particularly true in sports.
You know, I can't think of a team that's got more high and low experience, especially even if you look at the individual team players. So if you think of, let's continue to talk about your beloved Seahawks. You've got Russell Wilson, who has the polar opposite personal brand than maybe like a Richard Sherman, who is, you know, trash.
Why don't we go with a Colin Kaepernick, just as long as we're picking rivals? Just, you know, nice, good, upstanding citizen Russell Wilson, and then Colin Kaepernick, who has, you know, questionable judgment at times.
Let's just make that good boy, bad boy connection, because if you think about it, I mean, Russell Wilson, who, you know, you see him now in the Microsoft commercials with the, you know, he's definitely getting endorsements, and he was fairly quiet during the whole, you know, Super Bowl. We didn't see his name. He is a good boy, and he definitely has stuck with that personal brand. Which one actually pays off? Is it the bad boy image, like a Richard Sherman or somebody else, or is it the good boy, follow the rules, I'm a strong leader personality? Because it seems like the endorsements are going to the good boys.
Well, I think they both pay off, but they pay off in different ways, right? So Richard Sherman, who, by the way, is, you know, not just an extraordinary football player, but, you know, highly intelligent and very articulate and, you know, has a writing and broadcast career ahead of him, I believe. I mean, he's already writing regularly for Sports Illustrated and Stanford Educated, et cetera, et cetera. You know, what's smart about what Sherman has done is doing is he is capitalizing on his moment. And he's using his 15 minutes of fame at present, and maybe he gets 30 or 45 if he's that extraordinary, you know, to set himself up and give himself an entree into other conversations. Russell Wilson, you know, for years has been said, oh, he's too small and he can't get it done, you know, and he just does what he does, and he does, you know, he practices hard, and he reviews the game film when he goes to hospitals and spends time with sick children every Tuesday, you know, including during the season, you know, because he knows, or he has confidence, if you will, in his product that, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that's going to pay dividends. So I think it's actually reflective of two different strategies. One that is very opportunity driven, Sherman, both creating and capitalizing on opportunities for himself, you know, and the other is sort of the long tail strategy, where Russell Wilson is saying, you know, if I keep my head down and I play the game and I achieve the way I know I can, yeah, it's going to pay off. The question will be is if you add up the dollars at, you know, 10 years from now, you know, who will be in a better spot? Will Richard Sherman have made enough out of these short term opportunities, you know, to put him in the same place as Russell Wilson has, you know, by kind of slow playing it a little bit.
So, okay. I'm going to switch gears back to the White House a little bit because I want to be able to cover a couple more topics before we go. And it has been half the show about my favorite topic, which is shopping. So I'm trying to cover some things I know you guys are interested in. Let's talk about...
I like shopping.
What's that?
I like shopping, and my wife is a Stitch Fix subscriber, and we are both fans. I tried a men's version, and it, you know, I wasn't impressed with kind of their sense of my style. So I'm hopeful that, you know, Stitch Fix teaches the men's side of the fashion world to mainstream it a little bit more. Because I mean, look at me; I certainly would benefit from it.
I wasn't going to say anything, Brian. No.
You provided the headset. So this is not a fashion choice, by the way, that I opted for. I just want to note that this was provided.
You know, you have to tune into the pre-show to really get the whole experience with Brian, because he actually, we missed it, Cece. I think it was before you connected. He was showing us his snazzy socks that he's wearing. And socks for men. There's like a
what is up with socks?
I was gonna say the same thing.
I mean, I dig them. I don't get me wrong. I like, but I don't. That's one of the many things online that drives me nuts is the sock selfie.
It's the sock selfie. That's. I mean, I love socks too. I am a super. I'm anything fashion probably, but socks. I love.
Story.
But with men, it's like this crazy weird.
Because
well,
we don't have any other. I guess we don't have any other. What are we going to show? Our socks or our ties? There's nothing else we can really show.
And
I guess.
I rarely wear ties, but the story behind me wearing Argyle socks is I was in college. And, you know, like any other probably late teenage boy, I probably wore white socks, you know, with the majority of my outfits. And, you know, there was this girl who I thought was cute. And she was like, oh, I hate guys who wear white socks. And I was like, done. That's it. Like, that
nice.
Was the last time that I wore
nice.
White socks with anything that wasn't an athletic outfit. And then, you know, that was whatever, 20 years ago. So, you know, it's just a power of social, you know, social pressure at the end of the day.
It's funny. I think most men have probably had something about their wardrobe said to them at some point, and they're like, mental note, don't ever do that again. And women, we do have a lot of say-so, whether we intend to or not, over the men's wardrobe, I think. A lot of men, anyway. Okay, so there is the sock thing. We get a little off track there, but let's talk about the White House. So Hillary Clinton has a book, and she's got some really interesting ways that she's planning on releasing this book, right? The promotion plan, anyway. You and I were talking about this, Brian, and it includes some email exclusives. So what's up with that? I mean, she's really getting into the social space. She got active on Twitter, I think, probably, about a year or two ago. And I think she's, you know, what are we seeing from this?
Well, look, I mean, I think there's a couple schools of thought you could take on this or angles. One is, you know, lots of over analysis to see if there are any signs as to how she would mount a campaign to run for president, et cetera. But I really think this is just compelling book marketing 101. Email is still an incredibly influential marketing tool. It is it's a medium that allows you to deliver information right into somebody's inbox. You know, compared to ads or social stuff where you sort of have to be in the right place at the right time and in the right mindset to see an ad. And, you know, she's simply just driving value with content. She wrote a book, which from what I understand is going to be, you know, pretty extraordinary in terms of its insight into what it means to be Secretary of State and the decisions and how it's made. And she's a big personality, and there's an audience out there that's very curious about what she has to say. And so if you sign up for her email list, she's going to send you a little bit more than you're going to get in the book, or you're going to get you some, you know, she's going to send you some stuff before it comes out. And, you know, Cece, we've both written books, and, you know, it's funny to me that it's being thought of as innovative as it is, because it's like the same old playbook. She's just doing it well.
And yeah, it's book marketing 101. And the part that I thought was amazing was, I thought it was really smart that, you know, something as simple as an author's note, which is usually like the most boring part of a book, the fact that she's giving that as an exclusive, as you're going to read the author's note or listen to it, one or the other, is really smart, because she realizes the fact that, you know, it's content marketing 101. The fact that, okay, I'm going to put it out, you're going to sign up for this email list. Now I've got your contact information for anything else I might want to tell you about in the future, a campaign or fundraising. Plus, she's giving written so that the bloggers and the journalists can cut and paste it and put it on their sites or in their articles, or audio so that every news program and every radio station in the world can put it in and start using it immediately. And all the while this is a news story, when someone publishes it, every bit of it is earned media for her that she didn't have to pay for to market this book that's coming out. It's perfect.
It is really interesting. And for those of us who are marketers, we're looking at this probably in a completely different way than most people would, because I think that's exactly what she's doing. It's not really about the book, in my point of view. It's really about her collecting these email addresses, which are really going to be really important moving forward to stay connected. And I think, you know, email is not dead. It is actually a really powerful tool. How important was that for, you know, Brian, you worked on the Obama campaign. How important was that during that election period?
I didn't work on it, but I analyzed it and worked with a lot of the people. You know, email was incredibly important for the Obama campaign, has been for every campaign. But the big reason I think it was so important is because it's one of those formats, one of those tools that allows you to test and learn very, very quickly. So, you know, they're famous for sending out dozens, if not hundreds, of different iterations of emails and headlines and openers and calls to action, not just because they wanted to maximize the results that they got, but because each of those data points about the people who were responding would inform how they thought about that individual person. So if you responded to an A version and I responded to a B version, then at some point down the future, when it really mattered more, they would know not even to waste their time sending anything that resembled a B version to you, because you just weren't the data didn't back up the fact that that was something you would respond to. So it was all about gaining the intelligence. And because it is something that goes directly into my inbox, and because it is something that, you know, has so many potential different kind of data points integrated into it, you know, email is incredibly powerful. And I think still one of the dominant or most valuable forms of marketing that most people have just kind of ignored or dismissed, because it's not, you know, shiny and cool and sexy and, you know, quote unquote social.
Okay. Well, I think we're about out of time, but I want both of you to tell me something that you're actually watching. What's coming up? What's on your radar? What's on your radar, Brian?
Well, I'm getting ready for our June 10th show about the World Cup and the technology around soccer. But, you know, we're actually right in the beginning of summer. So one of the things that I'm really curious about is weather, and looking at a lot of how the different weather apps, the projections for storm season just came up. I was just reading a great interview. I tweeted about it by my friend Wendy Harmon at the Red Cross, who focuses on disaster response and volunteer engagement. So there's all sorts of stuff around weather and how it impacts the way we get and share information and the behaviors we take and, you know, the trips we plan and the things we buy. And so how the world of weather, the various apps and companies and whatnot focus on weather is something I've been sort of obsessing about lately.
Good. Something to watch. What about you, Cece? What's on your radar right now?
What's on my radar at the moment is Fargo. I'm headed to Fargo, North Dakota on Thursday, and I've never been. And I've heard that it's like a very cool, very artistic, very up. You know, all I think of wood chippers and snow when I think of Fargo. And I'm going out for this event called Misfit Con, where it's all these creative people trying to change the world and make it a better place, which is right in my sweet spot. So I've never been. So that's the thing immediately on my radar at the moment.
Misfit Con. That sounds like the perfect event. I love that already. It's all about what's in a name, right?
Yep.
Well, if somebody wants to connect with you, Brian, how can they do that?
You can start with my Twitter at BRIANREICH, or just Google me and things like that. I'm pretty easy to find.
And Cece, how can we connect with you?
Easiest place to find me is cc-chapman.com or my Twitter handle, which is, I don't even know how to point, right there somewhere.
All right, guys. Thanks again. That wraps up this episode of Marketing Mavericks. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Ready? That's this episode of Marketing Mavericks. And we want to hear from you, so you can actually follow me on Twitter. Use at Tanya Hall Radio and the hashtag Marketing Mavericks. That's the number sign Marketing Mavericks. You can email me at mavericks@twit.tv or just join us right here next Tuesday morning in the chat. Talk to you then. Thanks, everybody.